Okay, we did an introduction to the book. I have revised slides, and that's so have the same outline until we get up to where we got the last time. And actually, when I say the last time, that was 2 weeks ago. Because last week we looked at the issue of when Jesus started to preach repentance, which was a paper that I presented at the conference. Okay, the book makes reference to certain things that tell us that it is after Saul had become king. We have several passages that I've listed in the notes in Judges where it says, in those days Israel had no king. So the way that it's worded, Israel had a king at the time that the book is written. Saul became king in 1051 BC. As a result, though, of another passage, Judges 1:21, which is basically how far we got into the exposition last time, it tells us, to this day, the Jebusites live there. That is, they live in Jerusalem. So that gives indication that the book was written before David conquered Jerusalem. And if Samuel is the writer, and I believe that Samuel was the writer, it needs to be before he died. He died at some point after the year 1025 BC. Now, what I have depicted here on the pictures, you notice on the left picture that if you were to think of the peninsula of Florida, not the rest of the state, but just the peninsula, that juts out into the Gulf of Mexico, pointing towards Cuba. That is the historic part of Jerusalem. It's now known as the City of David. That's the area that the Jebusites had their walls around. In modern times, we have a cutaway on the right, and we were able to go through Hezekiah's tunnel as we were in Jerusalem. This tunnel was built in order to make it so that the water supply could go from the pool of the spring of Gihon, to a holding tank, which is known as the Pool of Siloam. So the cutout is showing where that tunnel goes, that is to this day running water from the spring of Gihon. When David conquered the city, the walls did not include this that was built around the spring of Gihon. So the spring was here, and it was outside of the city walls. And he was able to penetrate the city by going through the shaft that led from the spring. And so that was a vulnerable point. So in subsequent years, all the kings, including Hezekiah, took steps to protect the city so that if there would be a siege, that they would not lose their water supply. And that protected them when Hezekiah became king and when the Assyrians came down.
Why wouldn't they have just made this that part of the city?
Sure. We'll have other pictures. That is a rather steep embankment. And so it's easier to build a wall on the top of a steep embankment than it is to build a wall that encloses it. Because if you build a wall that encloses it, you have to make it tall enough to be an obstacle. Whereas if it's on the top of a sheer precipice or a steep incline, it was difficult for them to make really tall walls. They didn't have concrete. They didn't have rebar. They didn't have all the types of things that we have. And everything had to be done manually. And so they basically built a wall around the spring and the water supply, but that was as much as they wanted to do outside of the... But we'll have other pictures that will depict that better. Okay, for the chronology of the book of Judges, we would date it as starting at 1350 BC, and this is related to the time of the death of Joshua. And Saul became king in the year 1051, so we have approximately a 300-year period of time that is encompassed by the book of Judges. Now, the judges were not over the whole country, but you have individual tribes that a judge would rise up within a particular tribe. And so the map here is depicting that the various judges were at different locations. That turns out to be rather important for working out the chronology of this period, because a judge was not over the whole nation. If a judge were over the whole nation, then the chronology would create a real problem. We'll talk about that in a few moments. Now, when we look at the book of Judges, we find that a foreign power was giving problems to one of the tribes in a certain area. And we're told how many years that particular foreign entity held sway. In the case of the Arameans, with first judge Othniel, they troubled the nation or an area for about 8 years. Then Othniel was raised up by the Lord to deliver them from the Arameans. By the way, Aramean is also Syrian. So whenever you hear Aramean or you hear Syrian, it's the same thing. And the nation had rest for 40 years. Well, if you add up all these numbers, and you notice that some of these are question marks because we're not told how long a particular group of people troubled a certain area, and in some cases we aren't told how long the judge ruled and gave the nation rest, or the tribe rest. If we ignore the question marks and we add it all up, though, it adds up to 407 years. Now you notice that creates a little difficulty. We have to fit 407 years into a 300-year time slot. See the difficulty? Now, the way that it resolves itself, I have on the second page of the notes, since these different judges were in different parts of the country, we are not necessarily looking at absolute sequence that Othniel's time period finishes up, and after his 48 years, then Ehud goes the next 98 years, and so on and so forth. If they are sequential, then we have 407 years that we're having to fit into a 300-year span. But since these are in different parts of the country, there can be overlaps as well as there can be gaps between some of the judges. And so with that, I would say the book presents a general chronology, that is, Othniel was a long time before Samson, but it is not telling us that the 48 years starts and finishes, then the 98 years starts and finishes. We shouldn't take it that way. We do have one judge that we have a very specific time date, and his date does work out well for this to be overlapping and yet a general sequence. Notice in the notes about the middle of page 2, Jephthah was judged around the year 1106 BC because he referred to Israel's occupation of Gilead. Gilead is on the east side of the Jordan. Remember that 2.5 tribes took their possession east of the Jordan River. Well, we're able to date the event in Judges 11:26 as 1406 BC. And so Jephthah refers to an event 300 years earlier. That's about the only event in the book of Judges that you can say, here is a firm date. Everything else, we have approximations. How do we relate the book of Judges to the book of Joshua? Joshua, in general, was one of the high points in Israel's history. It was a time when Israel was relatively obedient to God's word. God had promised in Exodus chapter 23 that if the nation would take seriously its responsibility to evict the foreigners that were occupying the land, that God would give them land little by little. During the book of Joshua, there's a major conquest. The major portion of the book takes 7 years. But after Joshua dies, Israel lost its will to follow through on the provisions of the land covenant. They were willing to tax the foreign inhabitants that were in areas, pockets of resistance. They would tax them or they would make them do menial work, but they refused to drive them out. In some cases they said, well, they have chariots, they're stronger than we are, but God had promised that if they took seriously the responsibility he gave to them, he would go before them. But they lost their will. What were judges? They were not kings. We can see that very clearly because even through this whole time period, as well as in the time of Samuel, the nation was crying out that they wanted to have a king like all the other nations. Israel was supposed to be distinct. God was supposed to be its king. But they didn't want God as their king. They wanted to be like all their neighbors. They wanted to have a human king. They didn't want to be subservient to the Lord.
Okay. Yes, question. I was always under the impression that Judges kind of started like when Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, said, you need some help here.
Oh, okay.
Sanhedrin.
Okay, okay. Moses was told by his father-in-law, Jethro, that it was not good for Moses to be trying cases all day long. That he should try the difficult cases, but he should write down what the regulations were, and then you could have other people, judges, who would make the decisions on cases that followed in conformity with what Moses had already written down. So, yes, there were people who had positions of administrative judges to make rulings in cases. But what we have in the book of Judges is that rather than just making rulings in court cases, these people were administering and leading armies and doing all sorts of things quite different than what Moses implemented at Jethro's suggestion. It was like sort of a king. like sort of a king over a tribe, they were thinking about wanting to have a king over the whole nation, but a judge might be more like a governor. It's not the type of role that Jethro was suggesting or Moses implemented. This is a whole time period where they say, well, we don't have Joshua over us.
So the military, didn't that just kind of evolve from the original people who were in place of judging to where now we got to step it up? And
since there was no one other than the elders who were in place for about 20 years after Joshua, it probably just sort of evolved, just sort of developed. But that development did not happen until after Joshua's death and after the death of the elders. So it had not been something that was in play before that. Yes.
Would this, the type of judge that Roger's talking about, be somewhat akin to what it will be in the millennium under Jesus? What kind of government will there be under him?
I think there will be official governors, county administrators, mayors, and so on and so forth. It will be a structured government.
And what about Israel? Because it talks about
right, they will be over the 12 tribes. It's not saying that only they. I would assume that there will be at least one other that will be in that position with them, since there were the 11. Israel has descriptions there of rule over the 12 tribes. There would be rule within each tribe, and then within those there are going to be cities, and a city is really in biblical definitions more like a county, that it doesn't just include the city but includes the territory surrounding it. When I see in the parable of the talents, the statement, you've been faithful in a few things, I will make you ruler over 10 cities, it would be a state within a tribal area that would be large enough to encompass 10 cities. Then the next servant receives 5 cities. That would be a governorship over a state that had 5 cities within it. So each of those cities is going to be more like a county, but as far as our conception of things. But it will not be an ad hoc sort of government, which it is here during the time of Judges. It's one of the refrains that we see in the book of Judges, every man did what was right in his own eyes, which is another way of saying very few people were doing what was right in God's eyes. And so there were a lot of ad hoc sort of things that were going on. Interestingly, the book of Ruth takes place within the time of Judges. We will make the point of connection as we get further into the book. But you had Boaz as one who was not doing just what was right in his own eyes. And so there were exceptions, but the general statement was that people were pretty rebellious during the time of the Judges. Yes, Brandon.
So it's nice that you kind of brought a county. So like when you showed that map of like where the different judges were, I guess, in charge of at that time or the time of their rule or whatever. So would that be like counties, and that's why is that why there's different times like they would both be ruling at the same time, or the judges would both be in charge? Like since we have that time gap like between 48 and 98 with Open and Eden. So, like, say this person was ruling, and then for 4 years, and this person's going to rule for the next 8, but there's that time in between. Would they be ruling at the same time?
Okay. If someone is ruling in Manasseh and someone is ruling in Judah, there's a day's trip between them. They're different. It'd be like someone in Colorado versus someone in California.
Yeah.
So that's why you can have simultaneous. You can have overlap because they're not in the same place. Yeah. They're not affected by the same events.
So, but I guess my question would be more, were they knowingly having two people at the same time, or was it just that, like you said, that lapse of time between them?
Samuel is recording what had happened. Many of the events were before Samuel's life. Clearly, there were records that were able to be drawn upon, but Samuel doesn't tell us anything about the awareness and so on and so forth. It's an issue that's not addressed.
John, maybe part of the answer is each state or tribe was ruling by itself. They didn't see themselves as one nation at that time, right?
Oh, okay.
So you have a different ruler. I mean, really, all the way through, you have the North and the South. They never really saw themselves as one nation. But at this time, there's 12
little nations.
That are tribes and more concerned about themselves than
one rule.
The whole. Would that be correct, John?
Yeah. I would say that when people were longing for there to be a king over them, they were saying, we are really weak as we're individual tribes hoping to be able to overthrow this group or that group and so on and so forth. They knew what had happened under Joshua. They hadn't experienced it, but they knew about it. And I would say that you have people saying, we would like to return to that level of security. They saw security in a king. They did not see security in the Lord.
It's like equivalent to us still talking about World War II when all them wars happened in Vietnam. You know, generation, we weren't there, but, you know, our people still talk about it and everything. And it's something that was passed on.
Yeah, it would have been history that they would have been familiar with a lot of what happened. But they didn't give God the credit.
Yeah.
They saw it as happening at a human level.
John?
Yes?
Can I conclude that judges did not have a divine connection akin to the prophets?
Yeah, there is reason to say it's very much an ad hoc system.
Yeah, okay.
That would be a good characterization of the whole time.
Don't we have, John, though, the prophets come in when the king comes in to kind of counteract the king at that time?
Yeah, well, Samuel was in prior to the establishment of the monarchy. And so, in essence, he provided a balancing act, and there were a lot of things that were, I think, being made clear so that as the nation rebelled and wanted the king that they received, God told Samuel that they're not just rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Now, interestingly enough, the law of Moses anticipated the day that there would be a king and warned them about it. Because the only time that the kingdom will ever work out the way that God had intended it is when it is a theocracy, when Jesus Christ is administering planet Earth with Jerusalem as his capital.
Okay.
during the millennial kingdom and the eternal state that follows. Okay, you'll notice that there is a basic outline of the book. We'll be finishing up the first section, going through chapter 2, verse 9, which is background from the time of Joshua. We'll explain the chronology a little later. We have cases illustrating the actions of the judges, and then we have apostasy during the time of the judges. So the verdict on this period of time is that it's one of the absolute worst times of Israel's history. Let's see. I have here a listing of the 12 tribes with a mnemonic. You'll notice that Levi is in italics because Levi has no land. But the tribes of Israel with this mnemonic, Mabel says grind. So Mabel says grind coffee. And you'll notice I had to get rather creative on spelling the word grind. I made it as though it were written in Dutch. I-J. So Manasseh, Asher, Benjamin, Ephraim, Levi, Simeon, I dropped in an E to make it so you can say says, Zebulun, Gad, Reuben, Issachar, Judah, Naphtali, and Dan. These are the tribal allotments that we saw from the book of Joshua. Each of these tribes, after the basic conquest that's delineated in the book of Joshua, had to deal with pockets of resistance within their territory. And very few of the tribes took that seriously. Now let's start exposition. If you notice, in Joshua 1:1a, says, now after the death of Joshua. But now drop down to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, starting at verse 7, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. The way that that's structured, it is giving the impression that the preceding context, chapters 1 through 2, 6, occurred during the days of Joshua and is referring to the people serving Joshua. Let's look at verse 7 again. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua for about 20 years, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heresh in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. Then verse 10 talks about events after he died. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, that is, they died, and another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord. They hadn't seen the Lord working through Joshua, nor the work which he had done for Israel. It's in verse 10 that we're looking after Joshua. So doesn't it seem strange that we have it recorded twice that Joshua died? The solution that I would argue for is that the title of the book is actually Now After the Death of Joshua. That's the title for the book of Judges. Where we have attached at the top of our first page the book of Judges, that is a modern invention. The books of the Hebrew Bible actually have very interesting names, and it's normally the first sentence or the first word in a book is what is given as the title for that book. And so I take it, now after the death of Joshua is the intended title for the book. It's not part of the exposition. So running from verse 1b through 2:9, we are looking at events that happened before Joshua died up to the point that he actually died. So let's begin at verses 1b through 3. And here we have Judah and Simeon make an alliance. Notice that Judah's territory, according to the description in the book of Joshua, surrounds Simeon. So Simeon is like the donut hole in the middle of the donut. As a result, they made an alliance. The alliance is described for us in verses 1b through 3. It came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" So this is after the initial conquest by Joshua, and what we are told in verse 2, the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." So Judah said to Simeon...
Where are we at? Which verse?
1-2.
1-2? Okay.
Now we're in 1-3. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory." And Simeon went with him. So they formed an alliance.
On this, it said they're asking the Lord about this. And it says Joshua was gone.
No. Joshua isn't gone. Verse 1a is the title for the book. It's not part of the exposition. So you can push it up to the top of the page. And the sentence then begins, "It came to pass." And so this is during the lifetime of Joshua. It's after the initial conquest, and so there are still pockets that need to be taken.
And Joshua would have heard from the Lord.
Yes. Okay. So, Laura, this gets into answering your question that you asked, why didn't they just extend the walls out? If we were able to back away from this picture, but the way we came at it, we never saw it from down below. We actually started at the top, came down, so we got to this spot, but we didn't get any further perspective. This would have been walls of the city of Jerusalem that some of this is Jebusite walls. Down below here, we have a rather steep cliff. This would have been at the top, and in the area that's up there on the top, we actually have access to what would have been in David's palace. And so this is near the spring of Gihon. It's, but this is what the wall looked like. And you can imagine they would have had difficulties making a wall that would have been a serious impediment if they started at the bottom of a valley. Besides that, if they went down, people would easily be able to shoot arrows in from the other side. So they're wanting to be up as high as they can possibly be up there. And so the little inset picture, this is near the far end of that on the right-hand side. And you see that is a steep valley that it's going into.
It's like they use the side of the hill for the wall.
Yeah, the side of the hill, and then you have a wall on the top.
Yeah, so it's like twice as big, and then you have to do twice as much.
Right.
Smart, kind of.
Okay, this is one picture. You see where it says City of David over on the middle towards the right-hand side. Cheesemaker's Valley is what Josephus calls the valley that's on this side, and then the other side is the Kidron Valley, and you run into that word here and there in the Bible, including in the Gospel of John. And so I'll show it from another angle where it says C of D, that's City of David. And here you get a picture, you get an indication of how steep the embankment is down below the walls. And temple wasn't there at David's time and so on and so forth. Now, I'll tell you why I have enclosed this area of Mount Zion. When we read in verse 10 that they conquered Jerusalem and burned it, that was probably the unwalled portion of the city around Mount Zion. They did not breach the wall, they did not take it from the Jebusites, and we see that within the course of the chapter. But the initial conquest that's mentioned of Jerusalem, they probably burned the suburban area around Mount Zion. So you notice how the city of David sort of looks like the peninsula of Florida, and that it kind of juts out there.
I got a quick question.
Yes.
From that picture, there's people standing around it. Is that like a little model?
Yes, that's a model. And
okay,
we were there.
I was like, that's a small place. How did they end up building it? I know, it's silly.
Josh, you remember how long it took them to move that model when they moved it? Do you remember what it was like, an astronomical?
Yeah, it was a major task. It used to be at the Holy Land Hotel. They cut it all up in sections and moved it. I mean, it's over an acre in area. It's huge.
That's a model. That's cool. What is it made out of? Concrete or?
Limestone.
Limestone?
Yeah.
Because everything in Jerusalem is made out of limestone.
I never noticed it. How did they build it? Like, was there maps or something that they looked at to see how it was laid out and stuff?
This won't necessarily say that every building is exactly like that. And one of the other problems is this is a snapshot at a point in time. This would be what it looked like prior to the destruction in the year 70, but the city developed and grew and changed.
And it's still cool.
Just like
you were saying about the tomb and it being built over time, and that the tomb was actually be underground now.
Yeah, everything gets buried, because if you have limestone, you're building it, when it starts crumbling, either because of an earthquake or a battle or whatever, it just turns to gravel and they just build on top. And so,
John, you want to make just one comment about the Hinnom Valley there in Gehenna?
Go ahead.
I thought maybe you did.
Oh. From what standpoint?
Just the term Gehenna in the Bible.
Okay, sure.
Just so people get that all mixed up.
This location, you notice on the left-hand side near the bottom, Hinnom Valley. The word for valley in Hebrew or Aramaic is geh. So if you have the Valley of Hinnom, it would be Gehenom. Do you recognize the word Gehenna? Gehenna is drawn from the Valley of Hinnom. That's where in Roman times they burned their garbage. And the fires got going in the garbage heaps, and they perpetually burned. And so, people want to make all sorts of things beyond what was intended. And Dante's Inferno, and all people turn their imaginations loose and they come up with wild interpretations. But anyway, that's where it derives its name.
It looked like if you were going through there looking for something, you'd burst in the plane. It looks dry there.
Yeah, it's definitely desert.
So I got one more question. I know it's on topic, but so the city was already there. Did he know the spring was down at the bottom already?
Well, yeah, it's pretty easy to see that's where the Jebusites were getting their water from.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they would send down donkeys, and they'd be carrying up containers of water.
Yeah.
If any military general is going to keep an eye out for where is the water source for a walled city.
Yeah.
Anytime you have a water source that's outside of the wall, that's something that if you besiege the city, you're going to shut off their water supply.
So that would be my question. Was that their downfall? They attacked the water supply, got the water, and then...
They were able to get up into the shaft that actually led into the city. So they didn't shut the water supply off, but they got into the city and...
By watching them go back with the water or whatever, right?
Well, there's a text that describes it.
Okay. I just wondered.
Okay. So, let's see. I guess we didn't actually read that passage, so why don't we go ahead and... this is in 11:8. Actually, okay, wait. I've managed to skip a little bit. I skipped verses 4 through 7, and the reason I ended up skipping it is I didn't have a slide because no one has a clue where Bezek is. The only proposals I've seen are outside of the tribal area of Judah, so I know that's wrong. So I have no idea where Bezek is. Verses 4 through 7. Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. It may not be 10,000. That would be an astronomical number, but the word for 1,000 is Aleph, and the word for a military leader is also Aleph. So it may well say that they killed 10 of the generals of this particular king. So if you kill generals, you know that you've dealt with all the infantrymen that would be under them. So, and they found Adonai Bezek, which was the lord of Bezek, in Bezek, fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. He can no longer run. He can no longer carry a sword. Kings led their troops into battle. There was no such thing as a wheelchair general. You had to be able to fight if you're going to lead an army. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. So they did to him what he had done to others. And so forth. They didn't kill him, which was the normal procedure that God wanted done. There isn't a comment on this, but I think this is every man did what was right in his own eyes. They were, in my opinion, they were supposed to have killed him. So, you notice, Jerusalem was still in the hands of the Jebusites. They brought him there He wasn't killed, and he dies in Jerusalem. So now verse 8 is why Jerusalem comes up here. Notice, now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. Let me show you that this is only a temporary victory, because look at verse 21. But the children of Benjamin, Jerusalem is in Benjamin. The Valley of Hinnom is the borderline between Judah and Benjamin. Once you're north of the Hinnom Valley, you are in Benjamin. Benjamin was who was responsible to conquer the city and to take it. But they didn't take the area that's called the City of David. They never conquered the city, the fortified city, until the time of David. And that's many, many, many years later. They could not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem, so the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. So the Jebusites retained control of the fortified city. So when you read in verse 8 that Judah defeated Jerusalem, they didn't conquer the fortified city. They conquered a suburb.
At the same time, Benjamin was with them.
No, Benjamin wasn't with them. Benjamin is going to be doing his own attacks, but what we're told there is that they failed. We aren't told that they failed because they had a failed military campaign. So we don't know if they fought against them and didn't take it, or if they never fought against it. Notice, they could not drive them out, or they did not drive them out.
Oh, okay, I thought Judah and Benjamin.
No, it's Judah and Simeon.
Okay, against Jerusalem at the same time.
Yeah, we actually are not told that Benjamin waged a campaign against Jerusalem.
John, are Jebusites Canaanites?
They were a type of Canaanite, yeah.
John, I have a question. The scripture, when it uses the language "to this day," does that refer to the time of the author, or does it...
Time of the author.
Period.
Yes.
Which is why it has to be written before David, because David took this city. So that's why John was saying earlier, this has to be written prior to David, because of that. This comment. You see how it's a point?
Yeah, I do. But aren't there many places in Israel where they did not drive out the dwellers, and they inhabit it to this day, the present time?
You constantly run into the refrain that Israel never took Jerusalem. The first time that they took the fortified city was under David.
Is this where you were talking about also about the little places where they were supposed to, God told them to go take these places over and they didn't? They were like making little treaties and stuff like mm-hmm. that, and they didn't follow what God told them to do?
Right.
Also, they're in for it.
Yep. Yep. Exodus 23 says, made a promise that if they would go and fight, God would give them the land little by little.
Yeah.
But if they said, no, we can tax them, it didn't happen. Okay, so that brings us up to verse 9. Verses 9 through 20, we have the section about Judah and Simeon with all of their campaigns. In verse 9, afterward, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains, the highlands, this is a place known as the Shephelah, and then in the Negev, the south, and then in the lowlands. So I'll show you some pictures. Here's a Negev. Nice garden plot. And this is down south. Quite often your Bibles will, if you see south capitalized, is often the Hebrew word negev in the Old Testament.
So it just means south, Judah?
Well, it's... no, it doesn't mean south, but it's in the south. And so...
What does it mean?
I don't remember.
We
I don't remember.
The professor.
Wow.
Doesn't Negev end up being a city?
No.
No? Am I thinking of another city?
You might be thinking Gaza.
Or Nevaeh. Am I thinking of another city that begins with N? In the Old Testament? No?
Anyway, this is the Shephala. And you'll notice off in the distance the higher ridge that runs through Hebron and Jerusalem, Bethel, and so on. But the Shephala is like the foothills to that.
Looks like a better place to live, don't it?
Now, here's the lowlands that they're talking about. This is Gaza Strip. Now, I've shown two little inset maps of the Gaza Strip. Now, the reason I put two of them, the one that's on the right is showing you which direction is north, with north facing straight up. But the other one is showing you the Gaza Strip lining up with the coastline in this picture. So I figured that for some of you, one way is going to be easier to look at it than the other. So whichever you like better, look at that map. But you hear about the Gaza Strip regularly in the news now. The Gaza Strip is where the Philistines were. Now, when you hear the word Palestine or Palestinian, the Romans wanted to rub Israel's nose into things after the Second Judean Revolt, so they decided to call the nation Palestine after the Philistines.
Oh, that's jacked up.
And the British followed the same procedure, so they always called it Palestine. So all that's in honor of the Philistines. Well, the Philistines controlled the Gaza Strip. And that's this area. And we'll have other pictures. Notice all the sand dunes as you look there.
And that's what Goliath was, a Philistine, huh?
Pardon?
Was Goliath a Philistine?
Yes.
And were all the people big?
No. There are not very many seaports in Israel, and a major reason for that is almost the entire coastline has deep, deep, deep sand dunes, and once you get east of the sand dunes, you run into swamps. And as a result, transportation has always been difficult along the Gaza Strip, until you go inland, and that has turned out to be a blessing for Israel because it's a lot easier for them to keep freighters from bringing in all kinds of arms to the Philistines. Okay, verse 10. Here we have the attack on Hebron, and so in verse 10, then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. And you say, okay, that's nice. Kiriath Arba means city of four, which is very possibly pointing to an alliance of four kings or four towns in order that they would be stronger. And they killed Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Verse 11 then talks about the attack against Debir. The arrow on the inset map shows where Debir would be. And so this is what Debir looks like now. And so verses 11 through 15. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer, which means city of a scribe. Then Caleb said, whoever attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, To him I will give my daughter Achsah as wife, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Achsah as wife. Now it happened when she came to him that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you wish?" So she said to him, "Give me a blessing, since you've given me land in the Negev. Give me also springs of water." She says, "I'm not dumb. If you give me desert land, give me some water too." So she gave him a spring. He gave her a spring, excuse me.
And that's why she knows it.
Then in verse 16, we have the attack against Arad. And you can see I have an arrow pointing to where Arad would be. And so in verse 16, "Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms," that's another name for Jericho, "with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah," so that's the desert area between the ridge and the Dead Sea. So they came along the east side and came into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad, and they went there and dwelt among the people. Uh-oh. That wasn't a military campaign.
They were supposed to be temporary.
They're settling in. So here we're seeing that they're not obeying. Verse 17. Here we have on Hormah. "And Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah," which means destruction. Verse 18, we have Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. "And Judah took Gaza with its territory." So here's Gaza. Ashkelon actually is for that picture. I didn't have a picture of Gaza City. I couldn't find anything that looked old. All I could see is Philistine city, modern times. So I didn't give you a picture of that. But notice the sand dunes on the inset picture. So that's Ashkelon. And then Ekron with its territory. Here's Ekron. Verse 19. "Judah has had success because the Lord is with them." Verse 19. "So the Lord was with Judah. And they drove out the mountaineers," people in the Shephelah. "But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron." Now, the Lord would have given them success, but
they didn't believe and listened.
They weren't listening. Verse 20. "And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as was described back in the book of Joshua, and elsewhere I've listed passages where Hebron was promised to Caleb." Here's an overhead shot. This one is making the assumption that Mamre is now known as Nimrah. I haven't checked that out, but this is a good, helpful thing. In the very center, you see Tel Hebron, so it's like that onion skin that we've described. That's where the city was, and it kept getting built up higher and higher over the centuries. Now, in verse 20, we look at a new tribe. We're moving away from Judah and Simeon to Benjamin. "But the children of Benjamin could not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day." Doesn't give any indication that they fought at all. Now again, here we have pictures of the City of David, which is the area that was inhabited by the Jebusites. Here we'll have another picture, and you have to look closely, but where that circle is on the picture, the larger picture on the right, that is City of David. It's that Florida-shaped peninsula, and once again, you can look at the lower inset picture from the model to get an idea of what you're looking at inside the circle.
Now, can you guys go walk through there right now, or like?
Yeah, we were walking around.
I can't get my head around that. Sorry, just would blow my mind to be there.
Yeah, anyone want to share anything about time in Jerusalem?
Just that we were standing on David's palace, and you could see how steep it was to where he would have seen Bathsheba and her on the roof. It was kind of, I mean, you could see how the whole thing was set up made for him. It was set up, he's supposed to have to be out to war, but
right,
he's at home.
Right.
That's where you get in trouble, when you're not where you're supposed to be.
Seems to be a general theme from Genesis to Revelation. If you don't do what you're supposed to do,
seems to happen today to all of us.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
We're in Cambodia, and we're up on rooftop, and Steve said, now this is how table it looked.
And the fortified walls were really quite impressive. I can understand, I mean, if God tells you, go take the land, you take it, but it's, the fortified walls of the City of David were very impressive. To conquer that city would be a military operation. It would be substantial. So just the whole limestone buildings and walls, it was all just really cool. I don't know how to describe it.
You have to go.
Yeah, you have to go.
That's what you guys were saying, that big old piece of rock was about as big as a semi-trailer and all that stuff, right?
Later. It's not in the tower in David's city there.
It's impressive to take over.
It's up north to that.
You about the Jewish war. Yeah. It took the Romans to conquer and pound in the walls with the iron ram head. Boom! And then recording it, hearing it slam into the doors, and it's shaking. It's just, yeah. Was.
With regard to the temple stone, I paced it off. It would require length a little bit longer than from this door to that window there in the dining nook.
One stone?
One stone.
Mm-hmm.
And no one can figure out how they moved it, and they moved it.
There's nothing on the earth now that could move that one stone.
Yeah, after we finish, I'll put a slide up again of that particular stone. Now, that wasn't moved during the time of David. That was Herod the Great.
This is a hypothesis or an educated guess for moving stones that big. It would almost seem like it would have to be like a pulley system, like they would put the rock on something and have people like pulling it and use counterweight or something like that.
Yeah, what we know about their technology, we have no idea how they did it.
What brief description, what was their technology like?
Sticks and rocks.
Sticks and rocks.
Well, they did show that they had some pulleys, and that they would have oxen pull the pulley, and it would start to lift the stone up.
Yeah.
So they could get it on some. Remember that one place we were in, down underneath there, and then they would put it on some
timbers
or something like that, and start to roll it. But this is a guess.
But there's
nothing. I don't care how many oxen you have; they're not lifting that stone.
Yeah, and me and Chad were joking the last time about it. But is this the same time like there were dinosaurs? Did they have like these dinosaurs they were trying to have pull up the rock?
No.
I believe that man lived around with dinosaurs, so I'm sure man had to use dinosaurs in some way. Some they could tame and some they couldn't.
Giant pterodactyl.
Off track, sorry.
Okay.
Get off track.
Yeah. We have Ephraim and Manasseh in verses 22 through 26. And so they, if you look at the map here, Ephraim and Manasseh are right next to each other. So the description will partly encompass the two tribes together. And so here we're looking at the Jezreel Valley, which is the breadbasket of Israel. It's up in Galilee. It's where we were on day two of the trip. We were in Jezreel Valley day two, as we went to Sepphoris and drove past Nazareth and so on and so forth. And we were looking down from Mount Carmel, and I got a really neat picture of the Jezreel Valley here that we'll be able to show. Here's Bethel. It's in Ephraim. That's definitely hill country. And this is where the tabernacle would have been located in the book of Judges and 1 Samuel. Looking down Jezreel Valley from Mount Carmel, looking across towards Nazareth with the Mount of Precipice, which is the ridge that Nazareth is built on, but Nazareth is on the other side. Going east, close to the Jordan River, where the arrow is pointing, the tell in the background is Beth Shan of the Old Testament, and then the Roman city is in the foreground. And then here is Tel Ta'anach, which is also in Manasseh. And then
That last one, John, if you go back to that last one, I think that hill's where Saul and his sons were executed there, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And their bodies were paraded in, put on the city wall of Beth Shan. Tel Ta'anach is mentioned in verse 27. Ibleam, which is now Balama, is another place in Manasseh. And then Tel Dor is in Manasseh. Megiddo is in Manasseh. Megiddo, Har Megiddo, Armageddon.
What is that thing right there?
That is a high place. That's for worship. That was for worship of Canaanite false deities.
Oh, okay. Almost like an altar of some sort?
Yeah.
That is like 4,000 years old or something, I think.
Yeah. And then this is Gezer. This is in Ephraim. And then looking from Gezer over the Ayalon Valley, that's also in Ephraim.
Where did they put the 12 stones, you know, for each tribe of Israel? Where did they have those at?
At Gilgal, there was in Joshua, I'll have a slide of Gilgal. That's where they put the 12 stones from the river. But there are other 12 stone placements.
Are those 12 stones still there today then?
I don't know. Because it'd be hard to tell which stone. Those 12 were carried by one person each. They weren't huge. So I would say if they're there, we wouldn't know. Okay, so let's look verses 22 through 26. House of Joseph. Now, House of Joseph is mentioning the two tribes that were sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. They also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city." Particular way to get around the fortification, and we will show you Chesed. So he showed them the entrance to the city. They struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites. He said, I'm not sticking around here. Some of these people might put a contract out on me. He built the city and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. So he moved way out of the country.
Uncle Tom, he gave him up.
Verses 27 and 28 look at Manasseh failing to take Beth She'an, Ibleam, Ta'anach, and Megiddo and Dor. And so I showed you pictures of those. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth She'an and its villages. Notice, giving picture that cities are like counties. That you have a city and then it has suburbs. You would have farmlands and so on and so forth. So when you see city in the Bible, it's more like our concept of a county, including the city. And so, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam or its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites under tribute. They said, you can pay us some extra taxes and we'll let you stay.
Or his neighbor.
Yeah, they said, we'll just tax you. But they did not completely drive them out. Verse 29, we have that the Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites in Gezer. So they failed to take it. Verse 29. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwell in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwell in Gezer among them.
It would seem like they're very smart. Like, why would you go and try to capture these people and be like, hey, now we're going to work you and charge you? Like, it would seem like they would, like, against them, you know what I mean? Like, no.
Yeah, well, God said they would be a thorn in their side, and they were.
They sure were.
They were.
They still are.
Still are, yes, absolutely. And then Zebulun did not displace the inhabitants of Kitron or Nahalol. And so, verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. They paid extra taxes. And so here's Zebulun. Notice, and by the way, Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, is in Zebulun. And here's Nahalol. You notice they really set that up in a circular arrangement.
Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
It is cool. Kind of like modern.
Yeah, modern city.
That's all farmland out there.
Yeah, that's farmland.
Big backyard.
I wonder what's in the very center.
That I don't know. But you can look at Google Maps. Google Maps will show it. Yeah. And you can get down to street level and so on and so forth. So you can tour the place if you want.
There you go, Dean. So Google Maps and you'll be there tonight.
Amen. I'm sorry, John, did you say that Zebulun contains Nazareth? Or
yes.
Bethlehem or both?
Nazareth.
Nazareth, thank you.
Bethlehem is in Judah. Thank now, there. Let me say, though, when you read in the New Testament, it will say Bethlehem of Judah, because there is Bethlehem also up in Galilee. It's like you can run into Denver's in places other than Colorado. I mean, if you look at other states, there are Denver's elsewhere. And so, keep right. In verses 31 and 32, Asher did not displace the inhabitants of the cities in its land, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or Ahab, or Achzib, or Helba, or Afik, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. So I have pictures. Notice they're along the coastline, very far north, but if you look at this map, the land promised by God extended past Tyre. That's in Lebanon today.
John, is there any recognition of these ancient tribal boundaries today in Israel?
When you travel around Israel, people will say, well, that's over in, and so people will use the tribal designations for one way to refer to places. There also are districts, and the districts are governmental ones, but people tend to refer to areas by the old tribal names of the land inheritance. Okay, here's Akko, the modern city. But you can see some fortifications here that were put in by the Romans, or else they were in the medieval period. I don't remember on these. And then this is Sidon, up in Lebanon. And here is Tyre. Now, Tyre is a fascinating place. You notice that peninsula that's sticking out, and it says there the island. And then you have that neck on that land that's leading up to it. In Daniel, there's a prophecy about Tyre that it would be scraped to the ground. Well, what happened was Alexander didn't have a navy. And Alexander wanted to conquer Tyre, but the king and his army moved out onto the island. So rather than build ships, they scraped the city, scraped all the limestone buildings, and they dumped it and made a causeway. And so, before Alexander the Great, that was an island, that was not a peninsula.
They just pushed the buildings in the water?
Yeah, they just hauled it out and dumped it in the water.
Is there like five buildings and stuff in the water today?
Oh no, it was demolished buildings.
Oh, okay.
But the buildings were made out of stone.
Yeah.
So they just dumped the stone, moved the rubble out, and the army marched in against Tyre. And so that appears in Daniel, the prophecy. And so this is up in Lebanon. Here's Achzib. And so Asher is entirely along the Mediterranean. Here's the plain of Akko. So looking from Akko northward up to the ladder of Lebanon. You see that ridge of hills coming down at the northern end, and then way out west. That is a really scenic spot. I would have loved to have gotten up there just to see the ladder of Tyre.
Towards the top of the picture?
Yeah, on the right.
Beautiful one.
That whole place looks beautiful.
And this is one of three places named Afik, but this is often referred to as Afik Asher to keep it distinct from the others. Then we come to Naphtali in verse 33. Naphtali did not displace the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or Beth Anat. Verse 33. Nor did Naphtali drive off the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anat, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anat were put under tribute to them, so they paid taxes. Here is Beth Shemesh, and here is, this is for Dan. So verse 34 to 36, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. Now this is, let's see, I'm going to back up because I didn't stick a map here, and I really should have. Okay, when you land in Israel at Ben-Gurion Airport, it's in here. And so they'll always tell you, you're in the tribe of Dan. But Dan was driven out of there. They could not take it. And so they ended up settling way up north, and there's a town up here called Dan. that they said, well, we can't take where we were supposed to, so we're going to go up somewhere else. And they took that, and so
we're going to go somewhere else and try it.
And so Tel Dan was where we saw that neat dozer. We also saw the Canaanite high place, and I saw lots of interesting things up there. But Dan was not able to take the land that they had been given. I remember a question that my wife asked quite a while ago when we were in Joshua. She said, you know, some of these tribes don't get very big territories, and some get really large territories. The size of the territory was partly determined by population, but there's another feature. Some of the best land, some of the most important land, was in some of the small tribes. Benjamin and Dan are in a major route between the Mediterranean Sea and Jordan. That's just a major route there.
Trade route, right?
Absolutely.
The ancient world. When empires conquered the world at that time, that was a major trade route for the ancient world, right?
Absolutely.
Right, the crossroad where all the continents connected.
Yes.
So many of these people sound like us today. Like, you know what I mean? They said the whole world is just like, doesn't make any sense, they laugh, but it's like us, you know.
So is Zebulun north of Bethlehem? North east? Or north? Yeah.
Well, no, it's Nazareth area.
Nazareth.
Bethlehem is way south of there.
Zebulun's by Galilee, the Sea of Galilee.
This is one place where it's kind of handy to have a print Bible. Most print Bibles will have maps at the back. Mm-hmm. But I would recommend buying an inexpensive atlas of the Bible. It just is really helpful to be able to see where are places and so forth. It makes a lot of military campaigns and a lot of other things that are described make a lot more sense. So notice in verse 34, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, and they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Cherith, in Ayalon, in Shaalbim, yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Verse 36, now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim. Now that means the ascent of the scorpions. And there were some important battles that were fought over this pass. You notice it's southeast of the Dead Sea. This is giving a border for the land of Israel itself, an outward boundary from Selah and upward.
John, do you have a map of not just the tribes of Israel, but their enemies within their borders anywhere?
I have a map of that type in the Joshua study. Diane, could you jot down a note for me to put in a map of where the foreign inhabitants generally were within the land? I've got that map, but
it would be all over.
Well, it's different groups were in different places.
If I'm understanding correctly, they're going all over and they're supposed to be taking space over and they're enslaving these people and thinking they're just going to live there and be happy and charge them tax?
That's basically it.
No way.
Yep. So now, at this point, we're going to get a summary of what the Lord thought about this. And so in verses 1 through 4a, the angel of the Lord. Now, who is the angel of the Lord?
Jesus.
Yeah.
It's the pre-incarnate Christ. An easy passage for us to go to see who the angel of the Lord is. Go back to Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16, we have on Sarai demanding that Hagar and her son Ishmael be sent away from the house. And so Abram sent her away. We'll start at verse 6. Abram said to Sarai, "Indeed, your maid, that is Hagar, is in your hand. Do to her as you please." And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she, that is Hagar, fled from her presence. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring. And we have conversation that's going on. Notice verse 11. And the angel of the Lord said to her. So we've had the angel of the Lord speaking to Hagar. But now, look at verse 13. Then she, Hagar, called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. And you'll notice for the word Lord, all the letters are capitalized. That is an indication that we are looking at the word Yahweh. The angel of Yahweh is the Lord himself. This is God, in particular, is Jesus Christ, the one member of the Trinity who has revealed himself. So now as we go back to Judges 2:1, then the angel of the Lord, so this is Jesus Christ, came up from Gilgal. Now Gilgal is the place where the 12 memorial stones were placed and where Israel partook of its first Passover in the land and so forth. Here's Gilgal. Gilgal means a circle or a wheel. When you see Gal or Gil, it doesn't matter what the vowel is. In Hebrew, it will always be something round. Golgotha, place of a skull. A skull is round. And so you have all sorts of words that show up in the Hebrew Bible that are from this root. And they just repeated the root twice, Gilgal. It was, they placed circular arrangement of those 12 stones. This is a very important place within the history of Israel in the early days. This is where the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, which is where Israel was. We'll find out about Bochim in a moment. And he said, "I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You're not to put them under tax. You're not to reach an agreement. You're not to mix in with them. No covenants with them. You're under my covenant." And he says, "You shall tear down their altars." Guess what? They weren't doing that either. "But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you." So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now let's look at this a little bit. The type of a treaty that God entered into with Israel is a type of treaty that was common in this area in the 15th century B.C. The only treaties that we see of this type are those of the 15th century B.C. Hittites and the Israelites with God. It is called a suzerain vassal treaty. It's a treaty where a king makes someone his servant that will do what he wants them to do. here we can actually see, in one case, stone, and in another case, metal, one of these Hittite treaties, a suzerain vassal treaty. They always had a very regular format, and lo and behold, all of the book of Deuteronomy is arranged around the format of a Hittite suzerain vassal treaty. And Joshua 24 also evidences that format, as it recalls the covenant from Deuteronomy. And that's the covenant that God said, I promised you, as your suzerain, I wouldn't break the treaty. But you, Israel, have broken my treaty. You've made covenants with the other people. You've taxed them. You've moved in with them. You've started following their gods. You haven't smashed their altars. You've broken my covenant. They aren't looking very good on this report card.
No, they're not.
Yes?
Ezekiel chapter 16.
Yep.
The origin of your birth was in the land of Canaanites, and your father was an Amorite, and your mother a Hittite.
Yep. The only time we find evidence of this form of treaty is in Hittite regions during this time period.
So it's like God telling them, the deal is, this is the deal, and they're in for it.
Yep. And so the discipline that they're going to face in the book of Judges, all the problems that they face are because they have broken the terms of the treaty. So even under Joshua, the people were not wholly focused on the Lord. And even during his lifetime, the nation was preparing itself for judgment.
During grace now, we're not fully focused on the Lord.
Yep.
Well, you know what's cool? Even though they weren't focused and they were doing everything in their own eyes, God was still in control of the young nation eventually becoming unified. They were still growing up.
We will see evidence of God's deliverance and God's grace through this book. God takes his word seriously, puts people under the consequences for their actions, but God is not one who abandons his people.
Yeah. It's like a father disciplining his children. They got to take their licks first.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, he has promises to keep.
Absolutely.
That even though that appears like they're not going to be kept, he's going to keep them.
Yes. With God, when he makes a promise, it's a when promise, not an if promise. And there will be a time when Israel will be the beneficiary of the land covenant. That'll happen at the second coming.
So is it going to happen that Israel is going to repent? They will repent? Or
they will.
They will. So
they will.
It'll make it happen, or it'll happen and then everything will start happening.
They have to repent first before God will start doing what he said.
That
Deuteronomy 30 requires them to repent first.
Okay.
Okay. Let's look at verses 4b through 5. It's explaining why this particular location where they are became known as Bochim. People lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, tears. And they sacrificed there to the Lord. They said, oops, we blew it. We blew it big time. Their sacrifice is a recognition, yes, we are his vassal. We may be a rebellious vassal, but we are his vassal. He has the right to give us this report card. So then we have a statement in verses 6 through 9 that Israel partially served Joshua and the elders, and they buried him in his inheritance at Timnath-Heret in Ephraim. And when Joshua dismissed the people, children of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. Unfortunately, they didn't follow through on that. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heresh in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Ya'ash. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And guess how rebellious that one, that generation, will be. And yet God will prove himself faithful to what he has promised. Any questions? The place names, they're going to go flitting away, but Israel had a great opportunity, but Israel did not take the Lord seriously. They were a rebellious vassal under their suzerain.